You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Welcome, citizens, to This Day in History with Benjamin J. Goldson.
Yes, This Day in History, going back to 1951 for the nationalisation of the Iranian oil industry. This was done by the new Prime Minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, as a move against the sort of British who owned all the oil. It was the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, later to become British Petroleum. All the money, of course, was going overseas. A bit of it was being kept by the local Pahlavi dynasty. That was the group of Shahs, which is sort of their king or equivalent. And up until that point, Iran had been not directly ruled by the British Empire, but very much their local kings had been supported by the Brits to the degree that they had a very important meeting in World War II there.
Over the sawtoothed and snow-capped peaks of the Hamadan and Iraqi mountains to Tehran, the route flown by the British and United States leaders and their staffs to meet the Soviet delegates in the drafting of the plan for victory. The start of the four-day conference in the Persian capital, which, in effect, signs the death warrant of Nazi Germany. Impressive security measures had been taken for this critical and most momentous conference, which will shape the destiny of mankind. The compounds of the British legation and the Soviet embassy in Tehran were converted for the occasion into one great park. The ends of the street were sealed and closely guarded. It was at the Soviet embassy that one of the most moving ceremonies of the war took place. Marshal Stalin received the Stalingrad sword from Mr. Churchill, the magnificent token of British admiration for Russian courage, fashioned at the command of His Majesty the King. A British lieutenant acting as sword bearer steps forward to present the Sword of Honor into the hands of the Prime Minister. Taking it, the Prime Minister passes it to Marshal Stalin, who, after kissing the hilt, hands it to the savior of the steel-hearted city of Stalingrad, Marshal Voroshilov. It will be remembered that Mr. Churchill celebrated his 69th birthday in Tehran. The British press unit, knowing the Premier's weakness for hats, presented him with a Persian-style tetva. The same day, Mr. Churchill went to the Soviet embassy to meet the Shah of Persia, who was then paying a call on Mr. Roosevelt. We are deeply conscious of the hospitality and friendly help afforded the three-power delegates by the Shah. The following day, Mr. Churchill came out as an honorary colonel of the 4th Hussars and reviewed the troops drawn up in the legation compound. 20 men of the Buffs, 20 men from the Persian-Iran force, and 20 Sikhs. It was at this ceremony that he received three more birthday gifts. The PI force gave a silver cigar box, the Buffs presented a silver tray made in Isfahan, and the Sikhs a miniature painted on ivory. The presentations were made by Company Sergeant Major Calloway, Corporal Sutcliffe, and Kirpal Singh. Mr. Churchill was almost overrun as he signaled the men to come nearer so that he might thank them. It was the 10th Army's turn to cheer the chief. For the first time in this war, the three Allied leaders had at last been brought together from the ends of the earth. Following the design for Japanese punishment framed in the Cairo meetings, came the conference to decide the fate of Germany. The joint authors of this momentous declaration have planned the shape of things to come. Allied chiefs of staff, have formulated operational plans so gigantic in scope that students of war are already forecasting a crushing all-out offensive involving many millions of men. They feel that preparations are now very close to completion. But let us leave speculation to the wise. Let us dwell upon the concrete things that are open for all to discuss. The infinitely gratifying thought that Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin have set the ball rolling for the grand finale. That Britain, America, and Russia are bound together in invincible unity. Portal, Brooke, and Cunningham, three of the 70 British delegates who conferred with an almost equal number of American and Soviet representatives. Would it be accurate to suggest that Mr. Churchill wore the uniform of Air Commodore of the RAF in recognition of the colossal air blows being delivered by the Royal Air Force? Perhaps so. The stage is set for unprecedented warfare for our tomorrows and concord among nations for the days to follow.
So that was newsreel coverage of the Tehran Conference during World War II, held in Iran, of course, which was had been quite friendly to the Brits. This was changed somewhat, not massively, but probably too much for them to be happy with the election of Mohammad Mossadegh, who would pull Iran more in a sort of non-aligned direction, not entirely towards the Soviet Union, but not enough towards the America and England for them to be happy, aligning himself with people such as Nasser in Egypt.
Iran's British-hating Premier Mossadegh arrives in Cairo, where he gets a rousing welcome by 20,000 British-hating Egyptians. But Iranians at home charge Mossadegh was snubbed because Egypt's Premier didn't show up. Nevertheless, banners hail him as the destroyer of Britain. Mossadegh goes to a meeting with Egyptian officials, which brings a crowd-pleasing declaration of mutual friendship for each other and antagonism for the British. Then Mossadegh continues homeward.
Yes, probably should know. It's always good to remember in this day in history that these clips are taken from newsreels that were made by the British, so they're obviously going to reflect their biases. I don't think I should have to say that every time, but I think sometimes, like in this occasion, you might as well bring it up. So if it wasn't bad enough that he was hanging out with Gamal Nasser, who I think I talked about last week with the Suez Canal, Mossadegh then moved to nationalize his own sort of important infrastructure, and in ways this was a lot more important because it was the Iranian oil industry, which the West very much depended on.
Abadan, the world's largest oil refinery, which British enterprise and money built, may pass out of British control if Persia carries out the vote for nationalization passed by their parliament. In the barren, arid mountains of Khuzestan, in land where no crop would grow, in land that was just so much waste to Persia, British prospectors looked for oil, and only after 7 years did they find it in commercial quantities. There were no roads in the wild places where oil was found. They had to be built to carry the heavy equipment to bring the oil to the surface. Huge derricks had to be built to strike the riches of the earth. Huge power plants were needed so that when the derrick was built, there would be power enough to send the cutting bit maybe 2 miles down. A 150 miles to the coast, the oil must be moved. Great pipelines were laid through the mountains, and Abadan, an unknown desert spot, became one of the great oil ports of the world. To thousands of Persians, British enterprise brought well-paid work in good conditions. A vast modern town grew to make life pleasant. Schools for the children, classes to train Persians to do better jobs, hospitals, sanitation, food production units, all these the company provided from the oil shipped abroad. Successive governments in Persia have cooperated with the British. Let us hope that the Persians will not allow themselves to be intimidated by fanatics into a rash act which will lead to disaster for both countries.
However, they would end up nationalising the oil industry, taking away the properties of the Anglo-Iranian oil company, as I said, later to become BP, who I'm sure we're all familiar with, which very much angered Britain and... very much angered Britain and led to a later coup.
Abadan, the world's greatest oil refinery, passes out of British hands as the last of the British staff is evacuated by government order. When the men of the oil fields left Persia, a maintenance staff of 300 remained at Abadan. Now these two are on their way.
supported by Persian Oil Board Chief Maki, Premier Mossadegh first made negotiations impossible, then ordered the British staff to leave, defying the Hague Court's ruling that there should be no change. In New York, through Sir Gladwin Jenn, Britain asks the United Nations Security Council to intervene and prevent the expulsion of the Aberdeen staff while the matter is before the International Court, whose ruling Britain will, of course, accept. Sir Gladwin Jenn begins Britain's case.
My government has decided to bring their dispute with the Iranian government on the subject of the termination of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company's concession to the urgent attention of the Security Council, because they believe that, as a good and loyal member of the United Nations, this is the only course that the United Kingdom can take at the present time. No one can doubt the essentially inflammatory nature of a situation of the kind which now exists in those parts of Iran which are affected.
Soviet delegate Sarapkin's objection that Britain's resolution would mean intervention in Persian national affairs is outvoted, but Persia's request for a 10-day postponement to allow Mossadegh to face the council is agreed, and there's nothing to stop the evacuation. And so at London airport, the first of the last arrive, nurses who cared for Persian and white alike to the end, despite the trials and worry of the past months. And with them come some of the men who helped to make Aberdeen the wonder it is. Most of them deny they asked to be taken out and say they were prepared to stay as long as needed. In an office, Anglo-Iranian staff welcome the arrivals and speed their homeward journey. They have served Britain well under great difficulties, and Persia will miss their help. And now let a nurse have the last word. The question is, will the Persian hospital staff be able to carry on?
I think the nursing staff will put up quite a good show because they've been well trained, but they haven't been doing it for long enough. We were very glad to be home in England, but not glad to leave Aberdeen.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.